You're listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
City. Welcome to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast. I'm your host, Alexis Pereira. I was a guest on the last episode, and today I'm the host, and my guest today is Molly Thomas, who fans might know from We Know How You Die. You're on the Higgins show, the Instagram show, right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember when you got on Harold Knight, you were on Sherlock and Cookies,
mm-hmm.
and then... Was that how you got on? Did you just get on Harold Knight or?
I was put on Lloyd Knight.
Okay.
First, I was on Hotspur.
Okay.
And then I got moved to Sherlock and Cookies. No, Sherlock and Cookies and Big Margaret got chewed up and became Greg and Higgins.
Okay, sure.
He doesn't care. He just went, sure, sure.
No, I guess I just remember specifically because I think we were in a class together around the time you got on. Either Lloyd Knight or Harold Knight,
it must have been Lloyd.
Mm-hmm. Because it was you first got on, and also you were in that sketch show Standards and Practices.
Yeah, that was the first official UCB show that I was in.
Mm-hmm. So, you're a trained actor.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that. Tell me about your college experience and
sure. So I went to Indiana University and I studied. There's a BA program there, not a BFA, or at least that's probably changed now. But when I was there, it was just a Bachelor of Arts. And I studied theater and also English with the intention of becoming an actor. So I think that was a compromise that my parents and I made. It was like, yeah, you can go to school for theater. That's great. But it's going to be a liberal arts school and not a conservatory program.
Oh, my God.
Just in case.
That's exactly what my parents made me do.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And ultimately, actually, I mean, I loved going to IU. I love that experience just because there was so much, like, I studied English as well. And so just all of the, like, reading and writing, that's the dumbest fucking way to talk about college. But, my man, I did a lot of reading and writing. And that's what college is good for. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I went to college. And then after that, I was an apprentice at a theater company in Michigan, the Purple Rose Theater Company, which is Jeff Daniels' theater company. And so I did, like, everything you could do at a small theater company. So I worked in the office. I worked in the box office. I shoveled snow a lot.
Uh-huh.
I built the sets and took down the lights and put them up. And then I ended up being in a show there. And then short story long, I acted in a couple of shows. I got my equity card, lived in Michigan for a while, and then I moved to New York.
Wow. So
yeah.
Now tell me about your, well, let's just go from, through the timeline. So you moved to New York, you start taking classes. What would you say is like the hardest part of, getting into improv when you first started taking classes?
The hardest part for me about getting into improv when I started taking classes was that I was so interested in doing theater and mm-hmm. not doing improv.
Mm-hmm.
And so because I was like, well, there's no money in improv. Like, this is a fun thing. And I was on a team in college. I was on a short form team in college called Pumpernickel.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, oh, this will be like, I like this. this will be good when I audition for commercials. Like, everybody's told me to do this, but ultimately, like, you know, I'll be doing more theater. And so the thing that held me back the most was just not investing enough early on.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in the evenings, so I didn't see that. Like, I'm the student that didn't see that many shows through all of my classes. and when I first started, I thought, like, I never even thought about getting on a Herald team because I thought it was so competitive,
mm-hmm.
which is funny now
yeah.
if you realize that was like 2009, mm-hmm. 2010, and there are so many more people bouncing around now than there were then.
Yeah. I mean, we were in class together and I've seen you perform a lot. You know, you're just like you're such a fluid player. You know, and I feel like when I see you, like I just even recently saw you and We Know How You Die. And, you know, I don't know what it is. It's like you are one of these players who I see and I'm just like, you're just up for anything. And yet you never lose your point of view. Like, you know, how would you say you got to that point?
Thank you. I don't know that I would define myself in that way. I think up for anything, yes, hopefully. Like, mm-hmm. I try mm-hmm. to do that. Mm-hmm. I think I end up playing straight man a decent amount of the time. So when I'm talking to myself periodically about, like, what do I want to work on? I'll say, like, do some war. Come on, be the weirdo more. Mm-hmm. You're straight man enough in life. I'm the oldest child. Mm-hmm. I don't know. How do I you know, one of the things actually doing We Know How You Die, so I had been teaching for a while. I'd been on a house team for 3 or 4 years. And I think at a certain point, you start to think, like, oh, I'm good at this, and, like, I pretty much know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true, but when I started doing We Know How You Die, Connor Ratliff is on that team as well. And Connor knows what he's doing even more than I do. And he's somebody who's always thinking about improv and always looking of ways to get better. And he's somebody, like, his character is always advocating for themselves, no matter how much of a scumbag they are.
Yeah.
He always has, like, mm-hmm. a really good reason for being that way.
Yes.
And so, like, I think that's one of the things recently playing with Connor. And he coached Iggins for a while as well. And so between those things, between him coaching us and performing with him, that kind of made me up my game.
I love that. And, you know, that has, like, a light bulb for me, because now I can kind of see it now, especially, like, just, like, watching We Know How You Die. Talk about, like, characters advocating for themselves or, you know, for their point of view. What can you talk more about that?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, I think this comes from, or there's evidence of this for me in my acting background.
Mm-hmm.
So I had gotten the note before, don't be smarter than the character you're playing. So if you're playing somebody who, like, in a play, you know what everybody else is going to say, you know what's going to happen at the end of the play, you know what everybody's trying to accomplish. And so, but you can't act like you know those things, right?
Right.
Which is something that I think is difficult about acting with a script. And so, or if you're playing somebody who's younger or who's frankly dumber or who's a bad guy,
mm-hmm.
or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you want to make sure that you are living as that person and not pretending to be that person, if that makes sense.
Yes.
There's just that like film
mm-hmm.
that you can see. And so I think it's the same thing with improv.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think also that kind of goes with taking care of yourself first. I've heard this, if you take care of yourself first, that does more help to your scene partner than kind of like putting stuff on your scene partner. Would you say that kind of jives with that theory, or what would you say about that?
Well, I don't know. I think... I haven't heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. So that instead of, like, always labeling your scene, like, you're weird because of this,
mm-hmm.
but also this,
mm-hmm.
and you don't,
exactly.
and you're not thinking to yourself what your own thing is. But if you have two people who are taking care of each other as well as themselves, then maybe your scene partner will give you that gift that you needed, but you can't, you couldn't see. Because, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes it is easier just to see in somebody else, like, what's going on, or just an idea will come to you about why they're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it'll come to me, but sometimes it's easier for me to see it for somebody else. So I'm saying I disagree with you.
No, I love that. Because when I step out, I do try to pay attention to my scene partner. Obviously, we'll find out. But I think my number one goal is to snap into an intention and a very clear emotion, so that just if my scene partner is kind of like, whatever my scene partner wants to do, they know who they're dealing with up there on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, when I and you know, this is the other end, like sometimes where I'm just kind of like, oh, I'm more interested in what my scene partner's doing, and maybe, you know, this is just like the class of player I am. I find myself kind of being neutral, you know, and I'm not really giving my partner much.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, I'll see the scene kind of like drag a little because I'm just kind of like, what's going on with this person I'm looking at?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what you said is so interesting. Like, you know, if you just kind of like comment on, you know, not comment, but like if you kind of feed your scene partner and you guys feed each other, you can naturally get to a better scene. Like, so, what are you thinking about as yourself when you step out there then, when you're kind of working with the scene partner?
It depends on, you know, it depends on the opening.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're just, if we're doing organic improv or if we're doing something that's really premise-based, that's going to feel different, or if I'm initiating or responding. So let's say I'm initiating and it's premise-based.
Mm-hmm.
Then the first thing I'm thinking about is very clearly getting the idea across so that it's crystal clear for my scene partner, like, this is the unusual behavior or point of view that I'm pulling. So there's that. If it's premise-based and I'm responding to the scene, if I'm the second person out, then what I'm doing is intently trying to figure out what exactly the unusual behavior or point of view is that my scene partner is initiating.
Uh-huh.
With. Like, what do they want from me?
Yeah.
And because playing with the teams that I'm playing with most often now, I mean, everybody is so good that I know that they've got something,
uh-huh.
right? So it's my job to figure out what it is that they have and either what they want from me or what feels like a fun response
uh-huh.
for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's organic, if we're doing organic improv, then it's more, I don't know. It's more just like what feels right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Still, I mean, if I'm initiating, still get something out clear. Like, get out a piece of the base reality. Like, whatever it was that I was inspired by, like, get that out, make that clear. And also, I guess, I'm thinking about making a physical choice and having an emotional reaction. Not necessarily a big one, but just caring about what's happening.
Oh, you know what? That's it. I think, yeah, the making a physical choice also, because, you know, when people talk about taking care of themselves, then you can have two people step out and just do drastically different things, and just the scene just starts off like maniacal, and you're like, what am I looking at here? but I think that, like, taking care of yourself can also mean that emotional reaction and making a physical choice, and that's
mm-hmm.
almost all more than you need for the rest of the scene now, because you've made a choice.
Right.
I think that's what, you know, people are getting at when they say take care of yourself, make a choice.
Yeah. And I know, I mean, man, I've had that feeling. I don't have it as much anymore, but I used to really often have that feeling where I'd be on stage and I'd be like, I know what my scene partner's doing. I know what this idea is. I'm like, it was like I'm stuck in this body and I don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, I guess I know that I like birds. I don't know why. I don't know why. And for me, what's hard then is if it doesn't feel right. Like, if nothing comes to me, anything that I anything that feels inventy is going to feel inventy.
100%.
Right?
Yeah.
And so if no answers are like organically coming to me, that's when I get that stuck feeling of I just don't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why it's such a gift then when my scene partner goes, well, here's why you like birds.
100, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You don't want to watch improv where, you know, people are just like, you know, if people only take care of themselves and, you know, that's, then it's just people, two people looking at the audience and just being like, here's my thing and here's my thing,
back
and forth over and over again. And it's not collaborative. But I think one of the things that, you know, I do see is just like, that kind of like, you know, somebody initiates and the other person just goes, why are you doing that?
Oh,
that's crazy.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and I'm always like very interested in like, how do we get everybody snapping into something?
Right.
You know?
Right. For me, I think what I see, because I teach now and I mean, I haven't coached as much for the last couple of months, but because I teach, and if I do both too much, then I have nothing left. I'm an empty husk of a human being. I think it comes from a place of fear. Okay, so I teach a lot of 201 and 301, mm-hmm. and if your impulse is to be the straight man in that way, that's like, that's weird that you're doing that,
yeah.
right? Where you're kind of crossing your arms and looking at that person. Then, okay, as a straight man, it's a good impulse to state that, but you're not having any fun.
Right.
So your impulse, especially if you're that type of player at whatever level, your impulse should be, I think, more often than not, to just do the same thing as the first person who's come out.
Yeah.
It's so much fun. It's so surprising to see, especially if somebody's doing something really unusual, than to see the second person do the same thing.
Yeah.
So I think if you're leaning back and you're like, well, you're fucking weird, and you do that a lot, then, you know, have fun.
It's amazing. It's amazing how people look like experts just by doing what the first person is doing.
Yeah.
You know, when like I feel like you kind of almost instinctually, you see a player who just is like, that's crazy. And you're like, okay, that person's new. But then you see a person who does exactly what the first person, and you're like, wow, this guy is a veteran.
Right, right. And it's the same. Yeah, yeah. It's there doesn't necessarily need to be any difference in level.
Now you're a teacher. What do you see as a common bad thing? What's a common thing you're just kind of like trying to clear up with your players that with your students?
Well, I think what I just described is mm-hmm. is something that I mean, it's hard to teach somebody to play.
Mm-hmm.
And so I end up, but I note that a lot, like, just have fun, just do the same thing. Another thing is just repeat the justification. I know you're saying the same words over again.
Mm-hmm.
Truly trust me when I say,
yeah,
just say it again.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say it again and the whole class laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll come up to the next game move and they won't say it again.
And
they'll be like, hey, dude. Just say it again.
Yeah. I love that.
It feels like cheating, or, you know, it can be weird with side coaching where you don't want to repeat the thing that the teacher just said that feels lame.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's just, I guess, how simple it can be.
Yeah.
Is something that's really difficult to learn. It was very difficult for me to learn.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, that's like a person who's like underplaying at times. You know, you see that a lot. What about these?
He was going to say guys. You guys, he was going to say guys. It was going to be so gendered.
But, you know, these players who go out and they tell
these men.
A lot of jokes. And
these men, it's an epidemic. They look, everybody, there's just this group of men who comes to UCB and they're stand-ups, okay?
Yeah.
They're stand-ups and they come into your class and they just, no, this is all improv,
mm-hmm.
is all fabricated.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot of students who do that.
Oh, interesting. I feel like I used to see a lot of them. People just telling jokes out there.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a couple people do that. But I don't feel like I don't know. It is interesting that I tend to tap my chest a lot when I'm giving notes to people. Like, okay, did that feel real? Did that feel honest? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're bullshitting? I know you're bullshitting, right? That was a lie. Or like, yeah, that's now you're telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is not necessarily that they are giving like a real detail from their lives, but just like they're saying something that feels emotionally honest. They're saying something that feels like a human would say to another human
yes.
being,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. So maybe that's it. It's not. I don't see people telling jokes a lot. I just see people who. It's this trying to be funny, but it's coming from a pure place, like a pure place of panic,
mm-hmm.
and not, you know, trying to really make everybody laugh.
Right.
Well, it is trying to make everybody laugh, but in this, like, I'm just trying to do improv well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to say this crazy thing mm-hmm. purely because I'm panicking.
Yeah. And do you have, like, exercises where you kind of work with students to kind of start playing more honestly or... Or what do you do?
I really like the slice of life scenes where you just straight up do a scene. Like, I would assign students a scene like, you guys are married and you, like, you're both making breakfast. Got to give them an activity. And one of you is going to reveal that you've been having an affair, mm-hmm. right? So you do that. First, and it can be it's really interesting. It can be in an improv setting, whether it's a class or coaching a team. When we start getting into acting more, it can feel like you might not have signed up for this.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've signed up for this or not, and I'm not going to push you to like break down and sob. That's not what I'm here for.
Sure.
But if you can access that, you're going to be a better performer.
Yes.
So we're going to do some of it.
Yes.
So that exercise is you do this real slice of life, generally more emotional scene, and then you add a game. I would add a game to it. So I would say, okay, same scene, keep those same feelings. That's like the most important part, the same emotional reactions and feelings. But now instead of one of you revealing that you had an affair, you're revealing you broke your diet,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really helpful, especially early on.
Oh, that's great.
To see that you want to play it exactly the same way.
Yeah.
Just be saying funny things while you're doing it.
Hello, I'm Madeline Walter.
I'm Ben Axelrad, and we're both hypochondriacs.
I think I'm sick when I'm not.
And anytime I'm sick, I think I'm a goner for sure.
We're the hosts of Definitely Dying, the podcast that's a safe space for listeners and funny friends to talk openly about their medical dramas, both real and imagined.
We're part of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network, with new episodes released every Tuesday.
You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever else you love to get your podcasts.
Stay healthy.
People ask often, like, what's the difference between inventing and, you know, creating? Like, it's the same thing. You're up there, you know, you're making it up. How
right.
do you know I'm inventing? How do you know I'm creating? And I'm like, well, you called your son Little Timmy, or the
right.
that report was the Johnson report.
Right.
It feels like, to me, when I see invention, it's like people playing tropes as opposed to reality. But I don't
right.
know. What
or,
do you,
or panicking. Or panicking uh-huh. and just saying the first thing that comes to them. I would say if somebody asked me that, I would be like, you tell me.
Uh-huh.
Are you telling the truth? And they go, no.
I could never do that myself.
What? You
no,
can never
I,
say
I,
that?
No, I could never be like, oh, are you telling the truth? I'd be like, I believe you. If you I'd be a terrible teacher. That's why.
But sometimes I've said that to people. I'll be like, hold, okay. Little Timmy, have you ever met? I mean, Little Timmy, it's hard. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we all think that that's what every little boy is named.
It's unreal.
It's like we're all watching Leave It to Beaver or something all the time. But for something, I don't know, not that, but for something bigger than that, I'll stop and be like, okay, hold the fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you've ever said to your roommate before,
mm-hmm.
right? And most of the time, they go, no, mm-hmm. and they're kind of sheepish, and everybody laughs, and we all go, okay, great, so don't do that, right? And we reset the moment and keep going. And then if there are times when people are like, yeah, I've said that, I'm like, okay, I believe you.
Because
I don't
like
know,
that.
Especially yeah. when I'm teaching people, like, I don't know you. I know you as much as we see each other in class, but even the class knows each other better than I do because they're talking to each other at break and at shows and stuff. So if you tell me it's true, I'll believe you.
Mm-hmm.
But if I feel like it's not true, if I feel like you're bullshitting, then I will often call you on it.
I really love that because I love that you said sometimes they say, yeah, I did say it. And I think that what happens a lot is players get, like, frustrated because they're just like, huh, you know, well, God, I'm trying to up here, you know, doing stuff and my teacher's asking me whether or not it's real. But then I'm just like, you know what? It's on you, player. It's on you to, like, make these moves that feel organic.
Right.
That's kind of what we're trying to do here. So if somebody stops and is like, that didn't feel organic, that's on you.
Right. Then it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Anytime, I mean... Yes, teachers will be wrong sometimes, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
But when it comes to improv, they're probably right.
Yeah.
They've been doing, especially if it's like 201, 301, something.
Oh, my
I don't
God.
Know.
Yeah.
You know, the levels I teach, specifically mm-hmm. the levels I teach. So if you're getting defensive about whatever it is, that's probably on you. Mm-hmm. Like, I specifically remember my teachers giving me shit for not seeing shows. And I would get defensive because I was like, I work in the evenings from 5 until 10. But it was on me because I wasn't really committing to doing improv, right? I was committing to being there in the classroom. And I saw the shows that I needed to. But if I had really committed more to really learning it and to doing it, I would have learned faster and I would have been better in those classes.
There are times where, like in my 401, I didn't see my second show until the night of until the night before the class show.
Which is not allowed anymore, for the record.
It's unreal how bad I was. Yeah. And then my car broke down on the way to the I lived in Queens and my car broke down on the way to the train station. So like I pulled over and I was like thinking like, you know what? I better just not see the show and tell my car broke down and that's not my fault. And I want to like go back in time and just punch myself in the face.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what is like, yeah, no, I know, dude, like, yeah, your car broke down. But what do you not want to do this or
right.
do you want to do this?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But I think so often, I mean, everybody, the things that we want to do the most are the things that we put the roadblocks up
mm-hmm.
the most
mm-hmm.
in front. This is the most inelegant sentence.
No, you're absolutely right.
I did a lot of reading and writing in college, and yeah, here we are. But yeah, the things that we want the most, we put the most roadblocks up in
mm-hmm.
front of it, right? So
it's like roadblock and a pedestal. You're just like, well, I can't do that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very self-righteous reason for not being able to see my second improv show that's already included in the price of my class.
Yes, that's another thing.
Yeah.
What's most interesting to me is like you kind of – you're a trained actor and you were kind of not interested, at least you said, in getting to Harold. And yet you immediately just went like, boom. You're into it.
Well, I made a decision to be
mm-hmm. –
I made it a goal at a certain point.
Oh, okay.
So at first it was like, I have to get a job in the theater because I paid $1,000 to join the union and this is the work experience
yes.
I have. And then it wasn't happening
mm-hmm.
for me. And I was doing improv and I love doing improv. And for me so one of the things I loved about doing theater in Michigan, which is where I started my career and where I was doing theater, was that everybody was working as an ensemble and nobody had something better to do. I mean, people did have a lot of things to do
mm-hmm.
that were important. But when you were in the room, any room I was in doing theater in Michigan, everybody wanted to be there. Everybody was going to do whatever it took to figure out that play and put it on. And it was really joyful and collaborative. And auditioning for theater here in New York certainly did not feel like that.
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, and but I found that same spirit doing improv with my indie team and doing shows in the basement of the Triple Crown.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that was my main thing that I was doing for a while was just taking some classes and practicing and performing with my indie team, Astronaut Union. And then at a certain point, I went, no, fuck this. I'm going to be on a team.
That's good. Yeah.
And I was, you know, there were a couple things along the way that helped me I don't know, feel like part of the community, because that was a difficulty for me too, was just like making friends in the community and feeling like I wasn't an imposter trying to get things from people when I met them.
So
things like standards and practices helped me feel like, oh, I'm on the performer page now. I'm a performer here at the theater. I'm in a sketch show. I also do improv. Fuck this. I'm going to be on a team.
Yeah. Now let's talk about that, because I think that's actually a real thing that a lot of people don't talk about, is that kind of like, you need a hand, you know, often.
Yeah.
No matter what, in any theater, you need somebody to be like, you know, here, welcome. But, you know, you did standards and practices, and that probably was huge, because you were like, you became a performing, this is before Lloyd Knight, standards and practices? So that's huge, because now you're a regular performer, you're on the performer page. So you're like, oh, I belong here. I don't know, it's like so hard, because when you don't feel like you belong, it kind of hinders you in weird way.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah. I also worked for... I sold for the touring company, and I worked with Terry Withers, and that was another thing that helped me really feel connected. It was like, well, I work for this place.
Love
that. And, you know, so those two things, it was a number of things along the way where it was like, well, now I'm in the show. Well, now I work here. Well, now I, you know, whatever. I mean, if you just don't feel like you belong there, or if you want to belong, but you just haven't found a person that you've, you know, that you're genuinely friends with, and it doesn't feel good. So
That's
certainly, I think, true at any theater.
Yeah, it's, I think that that imposter syndrome, I think I've definitely felt that several times, like both before and like after I was like on a house team and stuff like that. So, you know, I think that if you're out there and just like, man, I'm trying to get in here, but like I feel like a weirdo, you know, I don't know. There's like it's hard, but you kind of need to like find some way to contribute some other way, and then like you'll feel more comfortable getting in there. I don't know what it is exactly.
Yeah, there's no magical solution. I mean, even if, because I'm not on Herald Night anymore, I perform on Sundays, and if I'm like hosting Herald Night or something, if I end up backstage at that theater on Tuesdays, and this isn't just for that show, but this is an example, I feel like an imposter there.
Interesting.
Like, I don't want to say hi to people if they're warming up, or I don't know everybody on Herald Night. So I don't know. It just feels weird.
Yeah, I think that there's this perception in all theaters, because I remember even in college and, you know, when I was doing like a little bit of theater, that you think it's a monolith that you're just like trying to climb, and it's, you know, like you're everybody inside feels the same way, and you're the only person who feels another way, and they all think the same thing about you, and you just kind of like, you have all these, you don't really realize that there's a lot of people in there with all kinds of like, they don't know what to do about certain things, they wish more people would help in certain ways, and like if you can like somehow get in there and help and, you know, do whatever, you know, you'll learn that like, wow, there are people in here who have neuroses that they like, you might see like a player who's just like it's really funny to me that you said that, like, you are like, you're on We Know How You Die and Higgins, two weekend shows. We Know How You Die is like not every week, but
it's once a month. Yeah.
But like that's like that's a major show. And it's funny to me that you're just like, even you're like, man, when I go back to like Herald Night, like, it, you know, you're just kind of like, oh, I'm on the outside here.
Right.
Everybody always feels that.
Yeah,
all
I
the
guess
time.
That's the lesson is everyone feels on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, like, what is the inside? Like, it's so funny to me. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know. It's probably just simply you can only be good friends with a certain number of people.
Right.
Right? And this is a community of, you know, there are a couple hundred performers at the theater, and then there are maybe 1,000 people, who knows what the number is, in the community here. And so you could be friendly with everybody, but you can only genuinely be friends with a certain number of people, whatever that is. And so inevitably there are going to be people you don't know as well. You know, I don't know.
So many moving parts as well. So they don't.
Right.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Now, tell me about We Know How You Die. It's such an interesting show. Like the way you guys take apart that opening, like,
Yeah, so this show, it was developed to perform actually at a theater in Washington, D.C. for 3 weeks, mm-hmm. at a theater. So, mm-hmm. man, was this like a real moment for Molly T, who got to be in a theater, uh-huh. like a theater. It felt like a real marriage. It still feels like a real marriage, yes. between improv and theater, mm-hmm. itself. And between silly and serious. Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's my sweet spot. So what we do is we will interview somebody about their whole life, and then we will do a show showing them their whole life, and then usually into the future some, mm-hmm. and then we will show them how they die. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So really it's basically like any other show that's based on an interview. What we do is magic. Nobody could ever do it but us.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But yeah, anytime you interview somebody, you're going to hit all of the funny, the unusual behaviors or points of view, all the games, all the premises from the interview. So we're doing the same thing, although we're doing it in chronological order.
Right.
But what I think for me is really special about that show, like one of the people that we interviewed who came to the show in D.C. Was a hospice chaplain. So I think a number of people who deal with death actually came to see the show.
Oh.
And I think culturally in the United States, we don't deal with death all that much. It's not, yeah. an integrated part of our lives. We try to put it off until we have to think about it, and then we think about it for a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so this really felt like, for each person that we did a show about, it felt like a celebration of their lives, and then this, you know, getting used to the idea of them dying and, mm-hmm. and making it humorous in this way. So that's why I love that show specifically.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about, like, it's an interview style opening. They're, mm-hmm. really not that, like, basically, you touched on this, but there's not that many different styles of openings. They're just all kind of like variations on a few different styles. Like, you know, there's organic, Sound of Movement, you know, doc or whatever, interview. Like, what do you say is like your favorite style of opening to do?
Hmm. Well, I'm probably always partial to the style that I'm currently, mm-hmm. doing.
Yeah.
So I really like doing an interview up top. I like doing no opening and just seeing, so then not starting with premise, starting organically and just seeing what happens. I've also been watching the pattern game a lot, and I think that can be really effective as well. I remember coming up and learning the pattern game, and it felt very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I watch it and teach it, the more it feels like this is like anything else.
Yeah. It's my favorite one too. I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is like anything else. You're really working as a team. You have to listen to each other so much up top.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody says some premise, and half the time it's dumb. But when your teammates make it right, like already you're supporting each other and building this really fun thing that you get to just use right off the bat in the scene. You get the suggestion, you A to C, until you hit something with some grit.
Hmm.
So when somebody says something that has some grit to it, and I don't think it has to be funny, it just has to be interesting,
mm-hmm.
Then you want to stop there. So that's the hallway. A to C is going down the hallway. Mm-hmm. Something with some grit, I guess that's the doorknob.
sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And then you want to pursue that. So like the second somebody decides, ooh, that was gritty, that was interesting, and I don't mean grit like dark.
No, I know what you mean.
Then you want to explore that idea. And the way that I teach it is we want three examples all exploring that idea in the exact same way,
mm-hmm.
and a statement of the premise. And they can come in any order. So if somebody says something and it strikes you as really funny and you're able to label the behavior or why it's funny right away, great. Do it, and then we'll hear three examples. Mm-hmm. If you know it has some grit, but you have no ability to articulate why, just do what they did again, but say something a little different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we'll start getting a couple of examples, and that will give one of your teammates time to think, oh, what are they all doing? And then they can label it.
Yeah.
And then when you have that little package of three, maybe four examples, and a statement of the premise, then you want to get the hell out of there. A to C again and get the hell out
Love
of there.
Love it. Yeah.
So that's how I teach it.
Yeah.
Pretty rigidly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's great. I mean, look, everybody, like, that's another thing. Like, you know, teachers may have differing philosophies, but you got to, like, play to each person's philosophy, because then when you get out on stage, you're literally playing with somebody's specific philosophy. So if,
right.
you, if you're not, like, if you're not open to your teacher's philosophy, you ain't going to be open to the philosophy that was thrown at you on stage in 5 milliseconds.
Right, right. Yeah, I think something like that, like pattern game, is, well, because we all learn it from different people, so we all learn it in a slightly different way.
Yes.
And so that can be difficult then when you have a group of people coming together who have all learned it from different people. Or, like me, when I got on Lloyd Knight, it had been a while since I had taken 301,
mm-hmm.
and I don't remember how much we were still doing pattern game in the classes I was taking, the Advanced Study Herald classes I was taking. Truly, when I started Lloyd, I don't think I knew what the fuck I was doing with pattern game. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, I really needed to listen to my coach there because, boy, oh, boy.
Yeah.
Also, our methodology changes because this art form is evolving. And so, like, I took classes before the book came out.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have the word framing, for example. Like, the language is different and the way that we play is different. And so there was just stuff that I either missed along the way that I didn't know that people who had started classes after me knew, or I had straight up forgotten because I was not one of those people who took notes in class.
Mm-hmm. Now, the second part, we talk about premises. We talk about the stuff that is missing in a lot of shows, and you know, including you and myself here, is a justification that you can take.
Right?
Can you talk about that? Like, what makes? Because I think justifications make your first scene can be pretty really funny, but then if there's no
right.
justification, that will deflate as soon as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you want to take the unusual behavior or point of view, okay? So that's, I guess, if you're on the back line after a first B of, like, what did we do that was weird,
mm-hmm.
okay? And then you have to have why were we doing it. So the first part is a premise, and when you have the justification, then you have a game.
Mm-hmm.
So unless it's a world game where it's just like we exist in a world where candy is drugs, cool, this is where it gets tricky, is because then you don't want a justification because you'll justify the funny away.
Yes, exactly.
It's simple enough that we all just accept it of like, sure, candy is drugs. If that's true, what else is mm-hmm. true? But yeah, if it's not a world game, if one or both of you are acting in a strange way or have an unusual belief, why is it that you feel or act that way?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's vital. And was one of the hardest things for me to learn was how to do it. I actually had a student who had been coached by an improviser here, Ian Heron, who he had said, like, my student said, well, my coach, Ian Heron, said this. And I was like, oh, my God, that's it? That's everything. And I actually emailed him this week because I could never remember what it was that he said.
Uh-huh.
But it's a justification is a philosophy, not your biography.
Love that. Oh, I love that.
I'm going to drop my mic right now, right, for Ian Heron. That's everything, right? Mm-hmm. We don't, like, first of all, it's not funny. Since your mom died, you've been acting this way. And also, that's your biography.
Yes.
Right? And so that's not unusual.
Uh-huh.
But what's... why do you like birds so much?
Uh-huh.
What's your philosophy?
Uh-huh.
Anything that can fly is magic. Okay, that's weird. So mm-hmm. we can, yeah,
mm-hmm.
that makes sense.
Yeah, that's so great. And also, there's a biography. You just start talking about the past, you know. And philosophy,
right.
you can talk about the future. You know, the biography is all like, well, this happened to me, and then I started, you know, then I believe in this, and it's like you just start talking about something that's not on stage with philosophy. It's like, all right, let's go forward. This is a guy who believes this. And then if he believes this, what else does he believe? Now right. We can take this person anywhere. Oh, you know, here's another question I always ask, like, really good players. Like, how do you approach second beats?
First of all, I just like to say I love sitting in this chair and having you tell me multiple times I'm a really good player.
You are a really good player.
Thank you. I'm not leaving. I think where would it be really fun to take this? But I probably don't even think that sentence to myself. It's like I'm scanning. Do we take it to a horse race? Do we take it to a delivery room? Do we take it to, you know, whatever? I just am listing. And then wherever it feels like it sticks or I can't get the idea out of my head, then that's where I'll take it. Another way I'll describe it to my students is, so that's the more intellectual way, I guess. It's when you can feel your devil horns coming out. Especially for somebody like me, again, oldest child, grew up like just really behaving. I guess one of the things that I had to learn was how to misbehave.
Yes.
A little bit. Yeah. Although it's interesting because improv, you're so much of it is being a good teammate and like being clear about premise and all of that, which I guess you could label as like, quote, behaving. But also, but doing just like really wild, goofy, audacious stuff. I have to keep pushing myself to do those kinds of moves. And so if you're on the back line and you think of something and it makes you smirk, your devil horns come out, do that.
Yeah.
And unless it's like, oh, this will fuck with Alex. Then yeah. Like, no, no.
Do you remember like the times you failed trying to come up with second beats and like where... I mean, it's basically, it's all you know, practice and stuff like that.
But. Right. I don't remember anything specific. I just remember the feeling of coming out and just being like, for 3 minutes until somebody edited. And feeling like that for a couple years.
Yeah. One of the weird things is, like, I remember, like, you know, it's just like, okay, the second beat is always the president and the third beat is God. You know, like, and then realizing, like, that's insane. That's not it at all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, here's the thing, though. That works sometimes. Like, sometimes you need it to be that. But you can't do that every time.
Yeah.
You can't do 3 presidential second beats. And especially now, you can't.
Okay, final question. Yeah. Again, getting to mind of a great player. You step on stage. You step on stage. What would you say is a mantra? Like, that, like, you know, what are you thinking?
God, I almost just said don't think, thinking it was an original idea and then realizing, oh, my God, I really thought that was an original idea I had was don't think. But also, it's kind of true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very true, of course. That's why it's on all of our merch. Mm-hmm. But I guess when you're starting out, you have to think a lot. So... You need to really think to yourself, what did that person say? What did they want me to do? And then once you've done it enough, that's when you need to stop thinking and just be open. I guess that's it. So I'm not really thinking about being open, but that's my goal, is to just kind of let it wash over me, knowing that I've played enough at this point that I will absorb all of those details that are said in an opening or that are said in an interview or something, and then just kind of let it flow.
I love that. And that was a long-form conversation. Tune in to the next episode when Molly Thomas will be your host.
You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting-edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at UCBtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy.